This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Philip Sheenan, is the author of the new book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. The book is about what happened behind the scenes at the 9/11 Commission, the disagreements within the commission, the political pressure on it, and the obstructions and deceptions the commission faced. Sheenan is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He covered the 9/11 Commission for the Times from the day of its first meeting in January 2003 until it closed down in August 2004. Then Sheenan covered how Congress and the White House responded to the Commission's recommendations. 8 of the 10 commissioners gave him interviews for the book. He also interviewed Commission staff members who had been told not to speak to reporters during the investigation. Philip Sheenan, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's talk a little bit about Philip Zelikow, who was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission. And he was chosen in spite of his ties to people in the Bush administration. Just run through for us before we go further what some of his connections were to the Bush administration and to certain key activities within the administration.
Well, he has and had lots of ties to the Bush administration. He had been a member of the 2001 transition team for the current President Bush, part of the transition that specifically looked at the operations of the counterterrorism team at the White House. He had previously worked for the first President Bush on the National Security Council staff with a young staffer by the name of Condoleezza Rice. And they formed a very close friendship, Zelikow and Rice, and went on after the end of the first Bush administration to write a book together. He had many other contacts within the administration. He had been a supporter of the incumbent President Bush's, and there had been a lot of speculation that he was supposed to end up on the Bush administration White House team. It didn't happen, but there had been a lot of assumptions that he would.
Well, two key connections I want to mention here is that he was, you write that he was the architect of the demotion of Richard Clark and his counterterrorism team within the National Security Council, and that Zelikow wrote the White House's doctrine for preemptive defense, which was used to justify the invasion of Iraq. So there was a lot of skepticism within the commission about appointing Zelikow to such a high position on the commission. Now, you just say in your book that while he was the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, he spoke both with Condoleezza Rice and with Karl Rove. Was that against the rules?
Well, early on, there had been an awful lot of suspicion early on in the investigation about Zelikow's ties to the White House. And he insisted to the commissioners and to the commission's leaders that he was going to go out of his way to avoid even the appearance of conflict of interest and that he would essentially cut his ties to most of these people. I think I have certainly learned over the course of the last 2 years that he was maintaining some of these relationships, in fact, and that he had, on several occasions, it appears, had some sort of contact with Rove. Both the White House and Zelikow insist that those contacts were entirely innocent and involved Zelikow's old work at the University of Virginia. But when it became known on the staff of the commission that Zelikow was in contact with Karl Rove, there was a great sense of alarm. Why would the executive director of the commission be in touch with the president's top political advisor? What possible explanation for that could there be? It also became known shortly thereafter that Zelikow had called in his secretary and ordered her to stop keeping a logbook of his contacts with the White House. And this was reported thereafter to the general counsel of the commission. And we don't really know I can't tell you what was said between Karl Rove and Philip Zelikow. I can tell you, though, that the fact that there were those contacts created a huge amount of suspicion on the part of the staff.
And there were also concerns, you say, on the part of the staff that Zelikow was using the commission to justify the war in Iraq in the early days of the commission.
I think we should point out that early on, people knew about some of Zelikow's ties to the White House. I don't think people knew all of them. I'm quite convinced they didn't know all of them. It really wasn't until the final months of the commission's investigation that it became known that Zelikow was the principal author of a very important document that was released by the White House in September of 2002 that sort of turned military doctrine on its head and justified a preemptive war. The United States could go to war against a nation that did not necessarily pose an immediate military threat to this country. And obviously, there was a belief at the time that that document was being written in anticipation of the invasion of Iraq the following year. The fact that Zelikow had written that document and the fact that that had not been widely known on the commission until the very late stages of the investigation, created a concern that Zelikow had attempted to use the investigation as a way of finding ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda that might have justified that invasion. At the end of the commission's work, Zelikow signed on to the staff opinion that indeed there were no clear ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda. But there certainly had been a view early on that Zelikow was interested in trying to publicly find such a connection.
You write about how Vice President Dick Cheney tried to limit what the commission could do. He didn't like the idea of there being a 9/11 commission. Did the vice president try to do anything to limit the scope of the investigation or to prevent it from happening?
Well, he was clearly at the forefront of the White House efforts to try to stop the commission from being created in the first place. There's an anecdote in the book. In 2002, the vice president made what seemed to be a very threatening phone call to Tom Daschle, who was then the Democratic majority leader in the Senate, suggesting that the Democratic Party would pay a real price if it attempted to air some of these pre-9/11 intelligence issues in the public. The vice president said that this would damage national security if there was such an open investigation, and suggested strongly that the Democratic Party would pay a price in the elections in November 2002. And you'll recall in those elections, the Democrats took a real drubbing. They lost the Senate. And it was a formidable threat at that point, because at that moment, President Bush and his team were riding high in opinion polls. They were about as popular as they would ever be.
Well, you write that Cheney said the White House would portray the Democrats as undermining the war on terror by holding the investigation on what went wrong on 9/11.
Right. And Daschle was clever enough to allow – he was being interviewed at that moment by a reporter from Newsweek. And he was clever enough to have the reporter remain in the room to listen to this conversation.
Vice President Cheney was one of the witnesses questioned by the 9/11 Commission, and the commission had some questions about the accuracy of what he told them. What was the specific thing that they questioned?
On the morning of 9/11, Cheney issued an order to the Pentagon to be prepared to shoot down any commercial plane that approached Washington. This is after the initial strikes in New York and Washington. And the information was relayed to jet fighters and the pilots were apparently ready to begin shooting down passenger planes if any came near the Capitol. Cheney insisted that he had given this order with the approval and after consultation with the president. But in fact, the commission staff over time believed that there hadn't been any such consultation and that the vice president had given this order without any approval, that it would have been an unconstitutional act for the vice president to give such an authorization, but it certainly seemed to be the case. At the end of the commission's work, Vice President Cheney apparently places quite an angry phone call to both the chairman and vice chairman of the commission to tell them to remove this material from the report. They don't. And I think if you read between the lines of the report, you can see that the commission is suggesting that it doesn't believe the vice president's account.
One of the more famous moments of the 9/11 Commission is, and this is featured in Michael Moore's documentary about the invasion of Iraq in the Bush administration. Condoleezza Rice says that there was no real warning about 9/11, and then she's asked to read the title of an August 6th presidential daily briefing, and the title is Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the U.S. You say that it was very difficult for the 9/11 Commission to get its hands on these presidential daily briefings that were used as evidence by the commission. Why was it so difficult?
These documents, they're called the President's Daily Brief, otherwise known as a PDB, and they're sort of the crown jewels of the intelligence community. They're an overnight digest, really sort of a super secret newspaper prepared for the Oval Office every day, in which the CIA tells the president what is sort of the hottest or latest news from around the world on a variety of national security issues. And up until the 9/11 Commission, these documents had almost never been shared outside the executive branch. The readership of the PDBs is, just a handful of people. The 9/11 Commission felt very strongly that, and Zelikow in particular, felt strongly that the commission had to get access to all of those PDBs. Certainly the PDBs that were given to President Bush and President Clinton about al-Qaeda. And this became sort of the biggest of the public showdowns between the commission and the White House refusing to make these available, the commission demanding it. There was even very serious concern on the commission, or a very serious move on the commission, to issue a subpoena to the White House, which would have been quite an explosive development if it had occurred. At the end of the day, the White House agreed to make some of the PDBs available, including this PDB you referred to, which was from August 2001 and was a reasonably clear warning to the president that al-Qaeda intended to strike within American borders. And the disclosure of the name of that PDB was indeed one of the sort of landmark moments in the history of the investigation.
My guest is Philip Sheenan, an investigative reporter for The New York Times and author of the new book, The Commission. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Philip Sheenan. He's an investigative reporter for The New York Times. He covered the 9/11 Commission from start to finish. When the 9/11 Commission's work was finished, he continued to investigate what happened behind the scenes at the Commission. Now he's written a new book called The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Some of the staff of the 9/11 Commission, you write, thinks that the Commission did an insufficient job researching the National Security Agency documents, the National Security Agency archives. What's the problem there?
Well, I'll tell you that in terms of the failings of the 9/11 Commission, in terms of its research, I think this is almost certainly the most serious one. The Commission got access to an awful lot of material of the CIA. It got access to an awful lot of material of the FBI and other agencies. And it was given access, or at least the National Security Agency, the big eavesdropping agency, said it was it welcomed the commission to come review its terrorism archives. But for reasons that escaped a lot of the staff, there seemed to be no interest in getting into the NSA and its vast archives of information about al-Qaeda and terrorist threats. And it's really only at the very last minute that somebody decides that they need to get in there to review them. And when they do, they find quite explosive material. The NSA, you know, is the agency that through its satellites and its ground-based wiretapping equipment really gathers most of the government's raw intelligence on national security threats and al-Qaeda and bin Laden in particular. And when a CIA analyst issues a report, that is often done on the basis of the raw information gathered by the NSA. The NSA is a very, very important agency in terms of if you want to understand the history of the government's response to al-Qaeda, and if you want to understand al-Qaeda's history, you need to get into the NSA to start reviewing the raw data. But the raw data really, or much of it, was just never reviewed by the commission. And the sort of realization at the last minute that they hadn't done that leads to a very frantic weekend trip by some of the commission staffers to the NSA's headquarters up in Maryland, where they try their darndest to get into the weeds of this material, but really can't do that in the very limited amount of time they have left on the investigation. There's a lot of concern that there are a lot of secrets still at the NSA that the 9/11 Commission knew nothing about.
Even so, you say that they did find explosive material at the NSA in the limited time that they had there. What did they find?
They found evidence that seemed to suggest that the government of Iran and the militant group Hezbollah had provided really important assistance to some of the 9/11 hijackers in the year and a half before the attacks. The Bush administration, most of the government, had been focused for so long on ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq that some of the members of the commission staff were surprised to discover that apparently there might have been a much closer link between al-Qaeda and Iran, and nobody knew about it. Nobody had seen this material out of the NSA until the very last stages of the 9/11 Commission investigation.
So do you know if anybody's investigating that material now and what the NSA is doing with that material?
Well, the NSA, to its credit, apparently has always been willing to share this information with, you know, legitimate government investigators. It doesn't appear to have hidden anything from the 9/11 Commission. I don't have any sense that anybody's gone in to review this material since. Certainly some of the staff members of the 9/11 Commission believes that some other body, some other group of investigators should try to get in there someday and look at it.
Is the problem that there's just so much of it?
There's a huge amount of it, but, you know, the commission did have 20 months, And the NSA offered up this material very early on in the process. And if they had begun the search earlier, perhaps they would have gotten through the bulk of it.
So why do you think they didn't?
Well, there are a variety of theories on the commission staff. One is that, you know, the CIA was just the sexier agency to investigate. There was certainly a feeling that Dr. Zelikow and the leadership of the commission were really fixated on the CIA and to a lesser extent the FBI and was really insistent that they get into their files. But the NSA, you know, which is, I think I offer a comparison in the book from one of the staff members who said, you know, the CIA was like Hollywood and the NSA is like a bunch of Silicon Valley geeks. And wouldn't you prefer to spend your time in Hollywood? And so there's great interest in getting into Langley, to the files at the CIA's headquarters in Langley. There's just no similar interest in going and speaking to the guys who run satellites up in Fort Meade, Maryland at the NSA.
You write a little bit about Bob Graham, the former Democratic senator from Florida, who headed a congressional committee that investigated intelligence failures leading up to 9/11. And one of the things that this committee found was connections between the Saudi government and at least two of the 9/11 hijackers. What were those connections?
Two of the hijackers go to San Diego in 2000, more than a year before the attacks, and settle in there. And they're settled in by this network of Arab expatriate men who sort of appear from nowhere to help them out. And some of those men, the people most involved in helping them out, seem to have been on the payroll of the Saudi government in one way or another. And they're also tied into a Saudi diplomat in Los Angeles working out of the consulate there. And the question is, why would these men sort of appear from nowhere to help these two bad guys as they prepared to carry out the terrorist attack? And Senator Graham, I think, felt that these sort of low-level intelligence operatives of the Saudi government had been tasked by somebody in Saudi Arabia to help out these al-Qaeda men. Senator Graham and the other members of his congressional investigation aren't alleging that the senior members of the Saudi royal family knew about 9/11 or had involvement in al-Qaeda, but they are saying that somebody within the Saudi government, and remember, you know, bin Laden at this point had a lot of support in the Saudi public, somebody within the Saudi government tasked these people in Southern California to help out these two men as they prepared to carry out 9/11.
Did the 9/11 Commission follow up this investigation?
It did. It had some terrific young investigators, including one who had been the principal investigator on these issues on the congressional investigation. He moves over to the 9/11 Commission and picks up the trail. And they develop an awful lot of evidence to show these ties, and they want the commission to produce them in its final report. You know, among the evidence they turn up, or they review at least, is information suggesting that money from the checking account of the Saudi ambassador's wife in Washington finished up in the hands of some of these sort of middlemen in Southern California. Incredible evidence of some sort of connection. And yet, at the end of the day, the commission chose not to put that in its final report for a variety of reasons that don't involve the commissioners themselves, but a debate on the commission staff.
What was the debate?
The leader of the team that was investigating the 9/11 plot was a very much admired former prosecutor, but who demanded a standard of proof before he would make allegations that couldn't be met by this evidence that that his investigators had gathered in San Diego. So his insistence that sort of 100% proof of guilt needed to be met in order to get it into the report meant that much of that material didn't get into the report.
Some critics of the Bush administration think the Bush administration has been too protective of the Saudi government, including too protective in the story of 9/11. Is there any implication that the Bush administration didn't want this part of the story to be included in the 9/11 Commission report?
I think there's a lot of concern about that. And there are 28 pages of material in the original congressional report that to this day have not been made public because the Bush administration insists that it not be made public. And my understanding is that material focuses specifically on these questions of what happened between the Saudi government and its possible operatives in Southern California.
So where is that part of the report now?
I assume it is sitting in a safe on Capitol Hill, unavailable to all of us.
And everyone on the 9/11 Commission had a chance to read it, that part?
Yes. The full classified congressional report was made available to the 9/11 Commission. In fact, the author of those 28 pages was an investigator on the 9/11 Commission as well.
Philip Sheenan is an investigative reporter at the New York Times and author of the new book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Philip Sheenan, author of the new book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Sheenan is an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He covered the 9/11 Commission for the Times, but much of the research for the book is based on what he learned after the commission's work was over, through interviews with commissioners and staff members. You write a little bit about how the Bush administration tried to undermine Richard Clark's credibility after he testified before the commission. And just to refresh everybody's memories, Richard Clark was a counterterrorism expert in the Bush administration, and he told the 9/11 Commission and everybody who was willing to listen that he tried to warn the Bush administration early on about the threat of al-Qaeda, and they just weren't willing to give him the time and the attention that he believed it deserved. What did you learn about how the Bush administration tried to undermine Richard Clark's credibility after he testified to the 9/11 Commission?
Well, when Clark went public in 2004, there was real panic at the White House. They thought this was a real threat to the president's reelection hopes and a real threat to the reputation of Condoleezza Rice. And they went all out in public and behind the scenes to destroy his credibility. And on the eve of Clark's testimony before the 9/11 Commission, the White House agreed to release a background briefing that Clark had given 2 years earlier, in which he appeared to support, offer very qualified support for the president's record on terrorism. This had been a briefing that Clark had given to a few reporters on the understanding that his name would never be revealed. On the eve of his appearance before the 9/11 Commission, the White House agreed with reporters to allow his name to be revealed in an effort to show that, you know, what he said 2 years ago is not what he is saying today. He is therefore a liar. Don't believe what he's about to tell the 9/11 Commission.
Do you think that that undermined his credibility in the eyes of anyone on the commission?
Clark had left behind at the White House a vast record of his efforts in dealing with terrorist threats, both in the Clinton and in the Bush administrations. And the staff knew that Clark's records backed up most of what he was saying to the 9/11 Commission, and as you say, to anybody else who would listen. You know, the record showed that Clark had repeatedly, daily, hourly warned his boss, Condi Rice, that, you know, something terrible was about to happen. And it appeared that the White House didn't often take him seriously.
When the report was being written, you write that the executive director, Philip Zelikow, said that the report reflected Richard Clark's point of view too much and Condoleezza Rice's too little, and Zelikow wanted more balance in the report. Was the balance of the report changed as a result of that?
Short answer is yes. I mean, there was I think some of the most tortured passages of the 9/11 Commission report are its treatment of this central question: who's telling the truth, Dick Clark or Condi Rice? Was the White House reacting quickly and appropriately to terrorist threats, or was it not? And what you have in the report is sort of Clark says this, Rice says this, Clark says this, Rice says this, you know, and dear reader, we're not going to tell you who's telling the truth. When in fact the staff believed very strongly that the documentary record and the information they were receiving from elsewhere showed that Clark's account was essentially correct. Yet again, there's no judgment made by the commission in its final report about what the truth is. And I don't think that would have happened had it not been for this insistence by Zelikow, and in fairness, the insistence from others on the commission that all this information be balanced out, that if an allegation was made, it be answered.
And well, you also say that Keenan Hamilton didn't want finger pointing in the report.
No, and I think, you know, I think in fairness to Dr. Zelikow, this decision not to have personal accountability, not to finger point, is a direction set very early on by Tom Kaine, the chairman, and Lee Hamilton, the vice chairman, And they repeated that at the end of the investigation as the report was being written. They weren't in the business of finding individual human beings to blame for 9/11, even though many members of the staff and certainly a lot of 9/11 families and a lot of pundits believe that there was clearly some blame to go around.
Your book begins with Sandy Berger, who was President Clinton's national security advisor, smuggling confidential documents out of the National Archives by stuffing them into his clothes. This is an infamous story. Why do you start there, and what did you learn about why he smuggled out the documents?
It's been a parlor game in Washington for a long time. Why would Sandy Berger destroy his reputation like this? It has an awful lot to do with Sandy Berger's personality. I believe he thought that if some of these documents found their way to the public or to Republicans on Capitol Hill, that he would somehow be blamed for 9/11. When, in fact, a lot of his friends and his colleagues will tell you that, you know, nobody was on top of the al-Qaeda threat like Sandy Berger, and he did a lot of admirable work in trying to prepare for terrorist attacks as they rose up. The answer seems to be as to why he stole these documents that, again, he thought that some of these documents might somehow implicate him in not having acted fast enough or done enough to deal with the bin Laden threat over time.
And were these the only copies that he took?
He kept stealing the same document. It was a report prepared by Dick Clark shortly after the Millennium threats. During the Millennium, the intelligence community was absolutely convinced that something terrible was about to happen. In fact, there was apparently a plot to blow up parts of Los Angeles Airport. After the Millennium period passed and there hadn't been a major attack, Berger tasked Clark to put together a lengthy memo saying sort of what can we do better in the future, what have we learned from this? And Clark came up with a long series of recommendations for future action. And it's this memo, copies of this memo, that Berger keeps stealing. Every time he comes across it, he puts it in his coat or he puts it in his socks or he somehow gets it out of the archives. And the belief is among his friends that he thought if that document became public in some form, it would be seen as a variety of actions that he could have taken to prevent 9/11 but didn't take. Again, I think that may reflect Sandy Berger as a catastrophizer. People who know Sandy Berger and know his record suggest that he's one of the people who might well have been saluted in the 9/11 Commission report for having been on top of al-Qaeda.
So did the 9/11 Commission end up with a copy of this document anyways?
They did. There were a variety of, I mean, this is one more mystery, that if he believed that no one would ever see this document if he stole every copy of it, he was wrong because there were copies elsewhere.
There's been a new development related to the 9/11 Commission that coincides with the publication of your book. The Justice Department announced that they're starting a criminal investigation of the CIA's destruction of tapes that showed harsh interrogations of two al-Qaeda terrorists. And, you know, the question is, did the 9/11 Commission want these tapes? Could they have used these tapes? Would it have been important to the commission? And the co-chairs of the commission, Lee Hamilton and Tom Kaine, had an op-ed in the New York Times. And I'll just quote some of it. They said the commission did not have a mandate to investigate how detainees were treated. Our role was to investigate the history and evolution of al-Qaeda and the 9/11 plot. As a legal matter, it is not up to us to examine the CIA's failure to disclose the existence of these tapes. That is for others. What we do know is that government officials decided not to inform a lawfully constituted body created by Congress and the President to investigate one of the greatest tragedies to confront this country. We call that obstruction. So Hamilton and Kaine are saying that the CIA destroying these tapes, that's obstruction of justice. What do you think of the significance of this story?
I think we're going to be learning over the next several weeks and months what the significance is. You know, this question of the al-Qaeda detainees and the information they provided to their interrogators, this was a big debate between the commission and the CIA with the White House on the sidelines. The commission went in early and said it wanted to talk to the detainees, you know, see them face-to-face wherever they were, and the CIA turned that down flat. There were a variety of negotiations that went on over months that led to a decision that the commission would be allowed to have written reports of what was being said by the al-Qaeda detainees overseas about 9/11, about the plot. And the commission would be allowed to submit questions to the CIA that would be asked of the detainees, and then the answers would be provided in written form. Every document I've seen suggests that the commission under this negotiation requested documents, paper, computer files. I didn't see any indication that they had ever specifically demanded videotapes. And it could be argued the CIA was operating in bad faith if it didn't alert the commission that it also had videotapes beyond whatever interrogation reports it had. But it doesn't appear that the 9/11 commission specifically asked for videotapes. And, you know, I think the allegation could now be made against the commission. Why didn't you?
My guest is Philip Sheenan, an investigative reporter for The New York Times and author of a new book about the 9/11 commission called The Commission. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Philip Sheenan. He's an investigative reporter for The New York Times. He covered the 9/11 Commission from start to finish. When the 9/11 Commission's work was finished, he continued to investigate what happened behind the scenes at the Commission. Now he's written a new book called The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. Rudy Giuliani recently dropped out of the Republican presidential primary race. But while he was in the race, everybody was joking about how every sentence would have a reference to 9/11, that so much of his campaign was based on his kind of heroic actions on September 11th and in the days following. But you say that the co-chairs of the commission, Tom Kaine and Lee Hamilton, thought that Giuliani's hearing was a low point for the commission and that the commission had abdicated its responsibility to ask him tough questions about 9/11. What kind of questions did they want to ask but didn't?
The staff, and I think the commissioners as well, felt very strongly that Giuliani's performance on the day of 9/11 was indeed heroic, and that he really comforted the city and the nation in a way that even the president wasn't able to do in those initial, you know, hours and days. But the staff was really astounded to discover how little the Giuliani administration had done to prepare the city for a terrorist attack. The city had been attacked. It had been attacked in 1993 by Islamic extremists. And what was their target? Their target was the World Trade Center. So why was it terribly surprising that 8 years later they would try again? And why in those 8 years had the Giuliani administration, with the understanding that terrorists were bound to try something someday, why had they not done more to respond to it? And they were prepared to ask Giuliani a host of questions about the city's poor preparation. But for a variety of reasons, they really asked Giuliani mostly softballs when he finally appeared before the commission. This was a time when, of course, Giuliani was about as popular a political figure as there was in this country. You know, people were talking about him as President Bush's obvious successor. And it was a very scary thing for the commission to try to tackle somebody like that. And in the end, they chose not to.
Well, Hamilton and Kaine wrote that it proved difficult, if not impossible, to raise hard questions about 9/11 in New York without being perceived as being critical of the individual police and firefighters or of Mayor Giuliani. So did that inhibited them from asking questions they wanted to ask?
Well, it's a little more complicated, but it was an interesting scene to watch, which is the day before Giuliani's testimony before the 9/11 Commission, the city's former fire department chief and police chief testified and really gave it to the commissioners, really gave it in particular to John Layman, who would ask some questions about the poor preparations. And I think they were particularly concerned about the potential for a showdown with Giuliani that would make the commission look bad. You know, at that point, Giuliani is so popular and he has, you know, the city's tabloids right behind him that the commission feared that if they gave Giuliani questions that were considered too tough, that they, the commissioners, would come under attack. And so, therefore, most of the questioning of Giuliani was extraordinarily gentle.
Meanwhile, it was recently reported that Giuliani's own terrorism experts warned him not to put the command center in Building 7 of the World Trade Center for a lot of reasons, including that there was a huge fuel tank at the World Trade Center and that the World Trade Center had already been a target of a terrorist attack and it might be a target again of an attack. Did you have anything to say about that?
Oh, well, I will say that, and in truth, I didn't fully understand this until I got into the research on the book. But just imagine this. The Giuliani administration decides they're going to create this $15 million emergency command post This is after the 93 attacks on the World Trade Center. And they're going to put it someplace reasonably close to City Hall, but at a safe location. And Giuliani's aides recommend that the command center be placed in Brooklyn or Queens, where it presumably would be safer than Manhattan, which was more likely to be a terrorist target. But Giuliani overrules them and decides that he's going to place his command center in, of all places on Earth, the World Trade Center. And he's not going to put it on the ground. He's going to put it, or underground for that matter, he's going to put it on the 23rd floor of a skyscraper. And, you know, what happened on 9/11 was almost too predictable. The command center had to be closed down almost immediately because there was a threat that it would itself come under attack since the Twin Towers were then burning. So the command center had to be evacuated. The crisis center had to be evacuated because there was a crisis.
Do you think, having covered the 9/11 Commission and then written this new book about what happened behind the scenes of the commission, are there lessons that you've learned that you think subsequent commissions should learn when they start their work?
Well, I mean, there's some obvious lessons in terms of, if you're not careful in the selection of staff, you can finish up with just these sorts of controversies about conflicts of interest. I think as long as people talk about the 9/11 Commission, they're going to talk to some degree about Philip Zelikow and his connections to and his friendships with many of the people who should have been the targets of the investigation, and whether or not that had any effect on the final report and the commission's findings. You know, I think at the end of the day, I wonder how much about Dr. Zelikow, Governor Kaine, and Mr. Hamilton really knew, and why it was that after those things were, after all of Zelikow's ties to the White House were pointed out to them, why they continued to stand by him.
Philip Sheenan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks, Terry.
Philip Sheenan is an investigative reporter at the New York Times and author of the new book, The Commission, The Uncensored History of the 9/11 Investigation. In response to the book, the commission's former executive director, Philip Zelikow, told ABC News that he was under no prohibition that barred his conversations with Karl Rove, and he did not recall asking his assistant to stop logging his calls. Zelikow says he did not discuss the commission's work with Rove. John DiIulio was the first director of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, which was created by President Bush shortly after he moved into the White House. The office gives grants and vouchers to nonprofit religious organizations that provide job training, affordable housing, after-school programs, and other social services. The office is controversial among people who say it blurs the line between church and state. But DiIulio hopes that whoever the next president is, that he or she continues this initiative. DiIulio is the author of the book Godly Republic, a centrist blueprint for America's faith-based future. He's a professor of politics, religion, and civil society at the University of Pennsylvania. John DiIulio, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You were set apart in your White House work by two things. One, that you were a Democrat in a Republican administration, and two, you were Catholic in a group of religious leaders that were largely Protestant evangelicals. How did being Catholic set you apart? What do you think they perceived as the differences between you and them?
I think the evangelical Christian leaders, many of them who I knew well and been friends with and served on their boards, nonetheless perceived a difference. And I think there is a real difference here, and it's not necessarily a bad thing on one side or the other, but Catholics tend to be more of the, in the spirit of St. James, faith without works is dead, or St. Ignatius, you know, it's deeds, not words, that matter most. And so, you know, we could have a Catholic inner city school. We'll have 400, 500 kids, none of them Catholic, you know, serving people who are not Catholic, not trying to convert them to Catholicism per se, but basically doing it because we're Catholic, not because they're Catholic, which is a different perspective than the perspective that says, you know, evangelism per se is the thing, or, you know, that the end game, as it were, really needs to be, you know, a gospel presentation, or, you know, wiring that into everything you do. Catholic perspective has always been more one of, you know, doing it, witnessing through your works.
While you were in the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, while you were directing it, did any evangelical leaders try to convert you?
Well, did any evangelical? Well, let's put it this way. When I started doing the research in the early to mid 90s, all the way through my time in the White House for sure, and even in fairly recent years, I don't think a week went by when somebody didn't ask me to sort of, you know, have a born again experience or make these. You know, in my view, I refer to myself as a born again Catholic because, you know, cradle Catholic, grew up Catholic, never. Was much of a high octane or practicing Catholic in my earlier years, and then in my 30s and whatnot, I became sort of more serious about the faith of my childhood, and so I had, I guess, my equivalent of a born again moment. But yes, people would always pop that. A lot of people pop that question at a lot of different times.
And how would you handle that?
I would tell them that thank you very much, and depending on the nature of the relationship, whether I knew them or not, and just say, look, I think I'm exactly where God wants me to be, in both civic and intellectual and theological and political terms, at least for the purposes of that of their particular question.
Now, you write in your new book that before you'd completed your first week in the White House as the director of faith-based initiatives, a small but vocal cadre of evangelical Christian leaders had called for your resignation. Over what?
Over the fact that I was taking this position that the initiative had to be open to all without regard to religion, that you know, it wasn't first and foremost and only about religious organizations, A, and B, that it would be open to Methodists, Muslims, Mormons, Quakers, Catholics, Jews, people of no particular religious faith, and that it would be measured in the end by the results. That is, could we partner with faith-based organizations in a way, staying between the double yellow constitutional lines established by charitable choice laws passed under President Clinton and supported by in a bipartisan way, that was really what this was about. And that drew a certain amount of ire and upset on the part of people for whom this initiative was to go beyond charitable choice, who viewed charitable choice as kind of a weak tea brewed to suit the tastes of secular liberals or whatnot, which whom I was most certainly not one, but nonetheless, they took exception to that.
I want to quote what was maybe your most famous quote
okay.
about the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. And this is the Mayberry Machiavelli line.
Yes.
And this was for an article that Ron Suskind was writing about you for Esquire magazine. And you said about the Bush White House, what you've got is everything, and I mean everything, being run by the political arm. It's the reign of the Mayberry Machiavellis. And you explained that what you meant by Mayberry Machiavellis was staff, senior and junior, who consistently talked and acted as if the height of political sophistication consisted in reducing every issue to its simplest black and white terms for public consumption, then steering legislative initiatives or policy proposals as far right as possible. These folks have their predecessor in previous administrations, but in the Bush administration, they were particularly unfettered. Mm-hmm. So you said that that really reverberated. And then you expressed your regrets about having said it. And I guess I'd like you to reflect on that whole process of being outspoken about something, making a very pointed criticism of the Bush administration and then kind of backing down from it.
Well, actually, it never not a complicated tale, but it has a lot of movable parts. In December of 2002, a memo that I had written became public, and Ron and other journalists grabbed hold of it and used it in various ways. But if you read the actual memo, it's a long memo, and there are parts of it that talk about other aspects of the administration. Now, the criticism, however, was pretty sweeping, pretty broad-brushed, and pretty harsh. And it was made really, I felt at the time, even before the memo became public and even before these other related stories appeared, I felt that I had been hasty, overly harsh, wasn't going to pass my annual Catholic self-examination of conscience. Now, that said, you asked me to reflect some 5 years later. As sorry as I am and I remain for the way that thing played out, I'm sad to say that over the past half decade, especially with regard to particular issues like children's health insurance and so forth, certainly with regard to the response to Katrina, where I've been down New Orleans a half dozen times since the levees broke, and you know, that city is still trying to recover, but the recovery would have gone much better if the initial response were better, et cetera. With regard to all those things, I'm sad to say that those criticisms have proven righter than I felt they were immediately in the aftermath of having made them, where I felt that I had been, you know, had been too harsh and too hasty and too broad brushed.
I'm sure you've been following the presidential campaigns, yes. Republican and Democrat. I think a lot of the Democrats and Republicans have been influenced by President Bush's public assertion of his faith. And there's a lot of talk about faith mm-hmm. in this election. And I'm wondering what your reaction to that is and if you think any of it's going too far.
I think that this presidential election year is unique for a lot of reasons. At least I better have some ideas. As an American government textbook author, I got to have some ideas about this, right? Do the revision. The faith in politics is here to stay. Faith base is a permanent part of the policy and the public discourse and vernacular, for good or for ill. I think it's on net good. I think that some of the candidates, like Senator Clinton in particular, and Governor Huckabee in particular, have done an especially laudable job of laying out how they think about their religion in relation to their public policy personas and their public policy positions. I think other candidates have been less clear about that. I don't think it's gone too far in the sense of them bringing it up at all. I think, you know, as my friend David Kuo says, you have to be careful not to get into a pastor-in-chief politics mode. It has a place. It helps to explain and flesh out why people believe what they believe. It's also part of the transparency we'd hope to have in our candidates. You know, why do you take this position on a particular cultural issue? Or why are you, you know, why are you so strongly concerned about the poor? That also could have, obviously, a religious basis or motivation.
John DiIulio, thank you very much for
talking
with us.
Thank you.
John DiIulio was the first director of the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives and is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Godly Republic. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.